It's just after 2. Time for Murphy on 1460 KXNO, Des Moines Sports Station.
Welcome to Sports and More. Until 4, it's the Murph and Andy Show on 1460 KXNO. Keith Murphy, Andy Fales, and Andrew Downs. And we start with the buzz, and the buzz is soccer. The United States men's national team, Team USA, loses to Trinidad and Tobago.
The whistle. It's done! It's over! It is over! Trinidad, with nothing to play for, has dethroned the United States, knocking them out of the World Cup 2018, missing out on the World Cup for the first time since 1986.
31 years, no doubt this hurts soccer watching momentum, which does exist in this country, even if you don't like soccer yourself. There's no doubt that momentum is building for this sport, Andy, but the United States missing the World Cup, this is a disaster for U.S. soccer.
It is, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know that I need to go any further than the fact that I'm just really disappointed. I'm really, really disappointed. I have gotten to the point in my life where I look forward to the World Cup. I mean, I don't count the days or anything, but when it gets here, I'm happy.
Me too.
I really enjoy watching the games. As somebody that does sports talk, I absolutely appreciate having that subject matter from the middle of June to the middle of July, right after the NBA finals are done. Until, you know, for another month, and that's a tough month, right? I mean, we don't talk about soccer every single day, but when the Americans play, you know, if they make it a couple of rounds, I mean, really, it picks up steam quick here.
And it was fun. There was a feeling of community, too, like those watch parties at the Royal Mile and at the keg stand where, you know, a lot of people gathered. And many of these people are not hardcore soccer fans. And here's where it does matter. I realize that those people who are really into soccer are going to watch the World Cup anyway. But like somebody like my wife, Jenny, for instance, she stopped and watched Team USA in the last World Cup. And she was kind of into it. Even when we were on vacation once, we took the whole family into a sports bar to watch the United States in the World Cup. There is 0% chance he's going to do that to watch some other countries play. It's just not going to happen. This, for some people, is a little bit like suddenly finding out, well, for those of us who are old enough, the United States not being in the Olympics. Most of us did not watch those Olympics when the United States were not in the Olympics. And I suppose that would be the same coming up here with some countries debating whether to pull out of the South Korea Olympics. If the United States were to not be in the Olympics, it would feel like this to some people. They would not watch the Winter Olympics.
I can't imagine watching the Winter Olympics if the United States wasn't in it. I mean, would you?
I don't think you would.
I mean, it was our connection. It was our common interest. I mean, we have our team. Yeah, I understand that there are people that just love the game, period, and they appreciate this level. But it's not the same when you don't have a local connection to it. I mean, we got a dog in the fight here, right? I mean, and not only that, it's been this fun position of worldwide underdog. We're not that position anywhere else, right? I mean, it's the United States. I mean, we're never an underdog. Here, we always were. I mean, you won one game. It was great. You won two games. It was amazing. People are dreaming of the day when we would, you know, be a world power. I feel like that was closer than us not qualifying at all, though, don't you? I
mean,
I thought we were getting better.
Yeah, that's where I'm at as kind of a casual soccer fan where, yeah, you thought we're getting closer, not further away. And I don't want to overstate this, but there's like a unity to it, right? We could all cheer for the same team.
Sure.
And
we need that more than ever.
It never happens anymore, right?
Yeah, we need that. And to your point, I think this caught many people off guard, and here's why. As I first noticed on the Bleacher Report, there were 27 possible win-lose-draw combinations between the U.S., Honduras, and Panama last night. 27 win, lose, draw combinations. Only one of the 27 eliminated the United States from the World Cup, and that one happened. One of 27. I mean, the World
Cup. So they had to lose and something else had to happen?
A bunch of something else's had to happen. And the World Cup, the qualifiers are stacked to get the United States. They want the United States in the World Cup. Imagine being Fox Sports today. They paid $400 million for the World Cup. And now they don't have the United States in it.
Yeah, the U.S. was up for the bid for the 2018, to host the 2018 World Cup. Imagine if the World Cup was here and our team wasn't in it. And like you said, I had no idea this was even in jeopardy. Not just last night, but like period. I knew that the men's national team wasn't playing real well. And there were a couple of games like last month where it was like, oh, you know, they're not doing real well. I had no clue that this was even a possibility that America wouldn't be in the World Cup.
And that was the power of the World Cup, too. I mean, it could take us from the point where we don't even know what's going on in soccer right now, all the way up to the point where we are counting down the minutes until the next game. That's amazing to go from absolute zero to a 10 in interest. I mean, that's another thing that doesn't happen very often. So I am genuinely disappointed about this.
Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall calls it the most embarrassing night in USA soccer history. Those are some strong words. So
I'll just have to take his word for it.
What went wrong? How bad is this? We'll let former United States men's national team player Taylor Wellman inform you.
It's not about tonight. It's not about Jurgen Klinsmann. It's not just about Bruce Arena. As a whole, U.S. soccer is not prepared. This is an utter embarrassment. You can't get a draw, a tie against Trinidad. If this failure does not wake up everyone from U.S. soccer to Major League Soccer, from pay to play to broadcasters to everything, then we're all insane. And if we don't change it, and I mean we, everyone in U.S. soccer, then what are we doing? What's the point? Because that should have never happened with the $1 billion plus that is going into Major League Soccer and youth development. That should have never happened, and it did, and every single person should look themselves in the mirror. And by the way, that's including myself.
The gloves are off at this point, and people got to be real. And
well, you and I have talked about this off camera. Well, guess what? I see that little red light. It's on, and yeah. I'm going to bring it up right now.
Okay.
The gloves should have been off years ago. We should have been having real criticism. And the discussion after Brazil, Max, was can we beat the Colombias and the Belgians and the Argentinas of the world?
Can't be
you kidding me? We can't beat Trinidad on a field that's too wet and too heavy? What are we doing? What are we doing?
What are we doing?
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah, that's great. And you know, Trinidad is one-third the population of Iowa.
Yeah, just a dinky little island.
And do you know what stadium they were playing in? Otto Bolden Stadium. He's the brilliant NBC track announcer. I mean, he's great, Otto Bolden. Every time there's an Olympics, I'm like, man, this guy is so good. There's a stadium named after him, and it's a small stadium. It's like, you know, Grinnell College-sized stadium. That's where the United States World Cup dreams came to an end, Otto Bolden Stadium.
Where is that in?
In Trinidad
Tobago. Jeez. Well, it didn't look like there were many people there.
No.
You'd think this would be the biggest news ever for them.
Well, they had nothing to play for. And they still
they had
won.
Nothing to play for.
They had nothing to play for, and they still won 2-1. We have a quickie poll, KXNO.com on the Murph and Andy Show platforms.
How much will the absence of the United States hurt your interest in the 2018 World Cup? A lot? A little, not at all, I will watch as much as ever, or not at all, I wasn't going to watch anyway.
A lot for me.
A lot for me, too. Like,
yeah, like all of
it. A fatal death blow.
Yeah, like, I don't know that I will watch a minute of the World Cup, and I was excited to watch America play in the World Cup.
I think I will, you know, try to watch a adopted country here and there. Like, oh, Ireland's playing. I'll watch that. But it's a lot. I don't even know that I would do that. I don't
you
know.
You just have to kind of check back in with me later.
Maybe the championship. If
it's a good time to have that. Again, there's nothing else for us going on. But really, I mean, how long? When you don't know the players, nobody else around you is talking about it. How interested can you be?
That's the thing. I always stopped watching as soon as America was eliminated. Anyway, I've never watched the final. I don't watch the you know. Things like that. I just
now, we have watched the final a number of times, though, without the United States in it. Remember the Zinedine Zidane? I remember watching that and being pretty entertained, but
I've watched it casually. Yeah, but I haven't had a rooting interest.
Right. I mean, you don't have a rooting interest, but you see it as the biggest sporting event in the world, and there's, again, it's the perfect time. There's nothing else for us going on here, so we watch it, and the United States never has a chance to be in that final, so it's not like there's any sort of sour grape feeling there. I mean, the fact that they're not in the tournament at all, I have that feeling, and I just kind of, out of spite, don't want to watch the tournament now.
Brian, Matt, many others, thank you. The host nation is automatically in the World Cup.
Ah.
So that's probably the next step. Hey, the United States has to host so we can make sure the United States is in the World Cup. So that would have solved that problem, and that does make sense. But, wow, this is a big blow. We also immediately see, and I saw it last night, it is like a showdown between the incredulous supporter who cannot believe that you don't love the beautiful game as much as he does. I mean, this is the biggest sport in the world. How can you not love it? And he's like incredulous about that. And the absolute dismissive hater that thinks it's stupid that you would even like this sport. Let me go back to yawning and not caring. How is anybody even talking about this? And neither one of those sides do themselves any favors. But I will say, for those who completely dismiss soccer as, oh, 40 years, it's been building momentum, it's going nowhere, that's just not true. There are cities now where the MLS teams sell out their stadiums. There are big crowds. There's more kids playing soccer in this country than ever. The English Premier League is a huge hit for NBC Sports Network. People all across the country watch that. Sports bars will tell you how big soccer is and how many people it attracts. It is a growing sport. There's nothing but numbers to support that. And if you don't care, that's fine. And to me, Andy, it's like Slipknot. I don't get it. I'm never going to listen to it. I'll never go to a concert. But I don't understand telling somebody else that they're stupid if they like Slipknot. And why would you, you know...
Bad comparison. I can almost see that side better than I can see this one, but...
Okay, country music.
I don't get the... yeah, maybe that's better. I mean, soccer is a fun game.
Slipknot rocks, by the way.
I can't do it.
Soccer is a fun game. I mean, it is a fun game to play. Played it like crazy as a kid. Many of our kids play it.
Yeah,
it's not this. We're not talking about cricket, something we don't understand. These people, yeah, I do get annoyed by the people that are just high and mighty about it and just cannot understand why you will not accept this worldwide wave. But to me, the worst person is just the stick in the mud. You know, just the guy that's just going to be flat out obtuse and say, no, I am never going to give it a chance. I don't care. I mean, if you're a sports fan and you have some sort of understanding of the game of soccer, and I feel like everybody does have some sort of understanding, then you could follow it. It's not that difficult.
You're talking about the guy who says, let me go back to not caring. You know,
or just, yeah, just people are just, soccer sucks. And yeah. they think it's so funny, and they got a bunch of guys, they high five, they got their little soccer sucks club.
Yeah, some people were happy.
They think that's original.
Night. They're happy that, you know, they don't have to deal with it for this next year.
Yeah, I saw some of that. It's like, oh good, now I don't have to pretend that America cares about soccer because America doesn't care. All of that. We'll take your calls in just a moment, but let's get that second quickie poll out there at KXNO.com on the Murph and Andy show page.
Yeah, who's worse? The soccer is the next big thing guy, or the incredulous supporter, or the nothing you can do will ever make America care about soccer guy, or the dismissive hater?
The dismissive hater is worse to me. They're both annoying. They're both annoying, but what do you care what somebody else enjoys? I mean, that's fine. You know, if you don't like Luke Bryan, that's okay, but let Chris Williams have his concert.
Yeah, but then guys like Chris Williams throw it in your face, like, oh, well, look at how good it is. You gotta look at his tight jeans and his 8 bracelets.
Well, which of these are you on, Andy?
I feel like I just explained that. Yeah, yeah. The guy who's just going to be obtuse about it bothers me more. I think the other guy, it's been kind of the cool thing for a long time to kind of hate on that guy most. But we are now to the point where the denier, the refusalist, is worse.
I can't hear the word obtuse without thinking of Shawshank Redemption.
How can you be so obtuse? What did you call me?
What did you call me? Let's take a couple of calls. Tyler with a thought on soccer as the United States will not play in the World Cup in 2018.
Well, I just wanted to say I played soccer, too, when I was a kid, but we called it a bunch of six-year-olds running after a ball and then getting in a big group of people and kicking each other in the shins as hard as they can.
Have you seen baseball at age six?
No. Any sport? Soccer, yeah.
I know, but I'm saying
basketball.
Any sport at age six is a little disorganized.
I just thought it was really funny. Like, the ball would be over there, and we're just kicking each other. Okay, anyway, I saw the Women's World Cup a couple years ago, and I'm not a huge soccer fan. My kids are, so I kind of get through them.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually watched the games, had no intention of being into those games, and I was really they were really exciting games. So as somebody who hasn't really liked soccer, I think USA Soccer has a really brilliant opportunity right now with all of the parents pulling their kids from football because of CTE and things like that. You know, how often do you get a concussion in soccer? I know you can get it from doing a header, kicking the ball off your head. But I think this is a great opportunity for USA Soccer to really put it into high gear and say, hey, if you don't want your kids playing football, you know, come over here. We got a great sport, and it's great for cardiovascular. Those are some of the toughest athletes to me in the world. I mean, they flop so they can get a breather. You know, so
yeah.
To me, I think it's a great opportunity for USA Soccer to strike while the iron's hot and parents are kind of pulling their kids out of football.
Thank you, Tyler. Call us back anytime. Those are good points. One thing, though, there are many concussions in soccer. It has led led to a change in the rules in most leagues. Some people push back about this, but that's it's like Julie Foudy is one of many people who has led the movement to not allow heading the ball until a pretty advanced age, much like those who say don't play tackle football until you're 14. The head of
young girls are especially susceptible to that. And my goddaughter has had horrible post-concussion problems, and she got it from soccer. So, but I do think, yeah, by and large, it's a much safer game for the whole body than football. And I think he's right. I mean, I think parents will continue to gravitate that. But we're already there. I mean, soccer is already a wildly popular participation sport here in America.
Mm-hmm. And it's growing in the high schools. You've seen in your years covering sports and news, just at Channel 13, how much bigger and how much more attention is given to the state soccer tournament in high school.
Yes,
attendance
there.
It's
a little bigger every year.
Yeah, it does seem a little bigger every year. Paul, you also see this as an opportunity for the United States to get better.
Yep, absolutely. And I'm an occasional fan of all sports, so I'm not a hater or super passionate, but you're absolutely right. A lot more kids are playing. There's probably a lot of great athletes right now that we don't know, and those in their 15 to 16. And they're going to see this as a chip on their shoulder. I see this as a chance to have people with a real mission, a reason to get us back in. And this could have been the best thing that ever happened to soccer for us.
Thank you, Paul. The Cubs and Nationals play just after 3 o'clock today in what could be the clinching game for the Cubs. Now, last I heard before I shut everything down, AD, was that Steven Strasburg had changed his mind and was going to pitch for the Nationals instead of Roark, which is not insignificant at all going into this game. Is that a fact or speculation?
I just pulled up the Nationals Twitter account. They tweeted about 2 hours ago the starting lineup. It does have Steven Strasburg
wow.
pitching.
Okay, so that is a change that Cubs fans want to know. Right now, let's play Guess Who's Birthday, presented by Rockstar Satellite of Des Moines, where you'll be able to watch the entire World Cup. Without the United States.
Andy, you're up. Guess whose birthday?
1987, it all changed. Tampa Bay traded to San Francisco. 4 long years, stood on the sidelines and studied Joe Montana.
That's Steve Young.
It is.
Steve Young is... Steve Young's 56.
He is 56.
Wow.
Well done.
Wow.
Murph, guess whose birthday?
Though he has been accused of corruption and favoritism, successfully turned the Russian economy around, boosted industry, and proved himself as one of the most macho world leaders.
Is that Vladimir Putin?
It is.
One of the most macho world leaders.
Macho world leaders. I'm sure he's come up before, but right now he could be anywhere from 45 to 65 to me. I don't know. I'll meet in the middle somewhere and say he's 57.
Now, so you're going to top end, he's 65.
Oh, well, he is in good shape.
He's one of the most masculinely dominant men in the world.
Andy, guess whose birthday?
This is what you get when you mess with us.
That's Thom Yorke.
It is. How old is Thom?
He is... He's 49.
That's a perfect cake right there. Well done.
That's fantastic.
Murph.
Congratulations.
Guess whose birthday?
Little Diddy. About Jack and Diane.
That's Ed Wilson.
Neil Hart. That's Bill Fenley. That is...
almost those three look alike.
John Cougar Mellencamp. I think he's dropped the cougar completely.
Yeah, I think he has too, but you are right.
Which is also what my friend did a month ago. John Mellencamp.
How old is the Cougs?
John Cougar Mellencamp is... He's 65.
He is 66. You get the point. Doesn't matter. Andy's perfect cake wins.
All right, at Iowa Wave Shirt on Twitter. They just started a Twitter account. It's at Iowa Wave Shirt. They just sent us a tweet that they have passed 6,200 shirts since Megan came on the show 2 days ago. So they have already made more than $120,000 of donation to the University of Iowa Children's Hospital.
That's really cool.
So you can follow that. It's at Iowa Wave Shirt on Twitter. The site is theiowawaveshirt.org, which is where you can order the shirt in adult or children sizes. So, man, that's a nice thing. All right, when we come back, the man who wrote a book being hailed as one of the top five sports biographies ever, Ken Burns calls him a master storyteller.
Whoa.
And Burns is so taken with this book that Ken Burns has announced that he will turn this book into his next documentary series. That's how good this book is. It's Ali, A Life. And if you thought, what else can we learn about Ali? You will find out from Jonathan Eig next on The Murph and Andy Show. The Murph and Andy Show, 1460 KXNO, and joining the program now is the author of Ali, A Life. It is already a bestseller. It is being hailed as one of the top five sports biographies ever. Jeremy Shapp called it top three. Ken Burns calls Jonathan Eig a great storyteller. Jonathan, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Ken Burns calling you a great storyteller, that's kind of like Santa Claus calling somebody generous. How did that feel?
Yeah, that felt pretty good. But Ken's such a nice guy, I think he'd probably say that about anybody.
And he is now taking your book and with your help turning this into a documentary series?
That's right. We're getting started working on an Ali documentary for PBS. It'll be out in probably about 3 years.
Wow, look forward to that. All right, let's jump in. There's so much in this 600-page book. You talk to more than 500 people for the book, so there's so much ground to cover, and we can't get to all of it. So let's start with just how much we've already learned about Ali. What was the inspiration for you feeling like there was more out there?
You know, I was a big fan of Ali as a kid, and there have been a lot of terrific books written about him, but nobody had done the full-blown biography where you go back and you talk to his kindergarten teacher and you get his FBI records and you talk to his ex-wives and you get the good and the bad. You know, a lot of the books turn him into this saint, and we celebrate him as kind of like a superhero almost. And I wanted to make sure that we understood him as a human being, that that means celebrating the stuff that is great, but also acknowledging the flaws in the man and treating him like you would an important historical subject and not just a sports hero.
Jonathan, what is one thing, or maybe the the biggest thing that you learned about Ali that as a fan, as an observer, you didn't know already before you started work on this book?
Oh, man, there were so many things. Just for starters, he took more than 200,000 punches over the course of his career. And by the end of his career, he was actually getting hit more than he was punching his opponents. So, you know, he was, we call him the greatest, but his fighting really deteriorated toward the end, and it took a toll on him. You know, he began to show signs of brain damage even in the early 70s, and then he fought for 10 more years. So that was really, you know, heartbreaking for me to see. On the other hand, there were some, you know, some things he did in private that were just astonishing. He was unbelievably generous. He would give away money to people. He would help people in need. He made friends with everybody he met. Sometimes it got him into trouble because he blew through millions of dollars. But he had a heart of gold, really.
We're also hearing Ali's name come up these days as kind of a comparison with when you hear Colin Kaepernick brought up and the like, bringing up controversial athletes who entered into the political arena. I like many of your readers, I am too young to remember Ali's prime or even be alive during it. Can you tell me just how controversial did Ali get in America?
I think it's a really important thing to point out because we treat him now like he's a saint, but he was the most unpopular man in America back in the 60s for a good several years. You know, he was seen as somebody who hated America, who was a traitor to his own country, somebody who refused to fight in Vietnam, changed his name and took on this strange religion, said that white people were the devil and couldn't be trusted. I mean, he was really out there, really radical, and stuck to his guns even when he was convicted of draft evasion and sentenced to 3 years in prison. He stuck to his guns. So we should remember that he was not always popular and that he stood up for what he believed in, but he suffered a lot for that. He lost 3.5 years of his career. He lost millions of dollars of endorsements. And it took him a long time before people began to accept him again.
What was the turning point? Was there a turning point where he suddenly became more popular than hated?
Yeah, I think you can pin it down to one precise moment, and I think it's the moment when Joe Frazier knocks him on his butt in the 14th round of their fight in 1971 at Madison Square Garden, because Ali had been so despised until that point. But by 1971, a lot of Americans think the war in Vietnam is a mistake. They feel like Ali suffered for his beliefs, that he paid his price, and then Frazier knocks him on his rear end, and Ali gets right back up and keeps fighting. And he loses to Frazier, but he keeps fighting to get another shot at the heavyweight championship. And that's when people begin to admire him. That's when they begin to say, damn, that's a tough guy.
That is still a long ways from becoming one of the most beloved figures in the world, the most famous person in the world, I think it could be argued, but also beloved here, the moment when he lights the torch at the Olympics. How did that art continue, Jonathan, to where he went from hated to full-blown beloved, and you know how people reacted to his death?
Yeah, that funeral last year was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I can't imagine anybody else getting that kind of a send-off where tens of thousands of people just line the streets to say goodbye to a man. And it is interesting to think about how that came to be because, as I said, he was hated. And you see it starting to turn around when he lights that torch in 1996. Before that torch, Ali was forgotten a little bit. He was depressed. He wasn't getting any attention from the media. He was in bad shape from Parkinson's, so he didn't like being on TV. But when he lights that torch, America kind of rediscovers him and says, oh, look at him. You know, he's been through so much, and we've been through so much together, and he's harmless now. And, you know, it's a little bit sad that we only love him when he's harmless. But it's almost as if we, you know, Americans forgave him for all of the outrage and all the anger that he had that they had felt toward him earlier.
Jonathan, the Ali that I remember was way past his prime. It was, you know, starting with Leon Spinks and going on from there, where he was more of a caricature of his former self. And then he just kept fighting and kept on retiring. Why did he continue, in your opinion, why did he continue on so far past his prime?
I think the answer is really simple. It was money. You know, he was married three times at that point, and he had alimony to pay. He had kids to support. He had an entourage that counted on him. And he liked the attention. He liked the fact that he could earn a couple million bucks for one night's work. It's very hard to give that up. It's very hard to give up the spotlight when you're, you know, you're addicted to it, to attention the way Ali was. He just, he loved being the star of the show. And I think he knew that without boxing, it was never going to be the same.
Jonathan Eig is the author of Ali, A Life, already a bestseller. We've seen the documentary where Ali is preparing to fight Larry Holmes, and Holmes is really uncomfortable about fighting, and you can see from the interviews that Ali should not be fighting. How aware were those close to him that that this man should not be in the ring, and at what point did they realize it?
You know, I talked to one of Ali's sparring partners, Tim Witherspoon, who said that he thought Ali was going to be killed if he got into the ring, and he went to Ali's trainer and complained and said, "You can't let him do this. You can't let him fight." There was concern about Ali's health. He was taking all kinds of pills leading up to the fight, and they just couldn't call it off. They were afraid that if they called it off, they'd lose so much money. And you know, Ferdy Pacheco said he thought it was you know, they were negligent to the point of being criminal. That the people who let Ali get in the ring there should have gone to jail for that behavior. And Ali, not a lot of people know this, he failed his drug test after that fight and was banned from boxing in Nevada as a result. So it was a tragedy.
What did he
fail? What did they find?
Yeah, what did they find in the test?
They found painkillers and speed. So It may have been to lose weight. It may have been to absorb some of the pain of training or the blows he absorbed in sparring. It was a sad chapter in Ali's life.
Looking back with the memory of a kid, I still revere those three Ali Frazier fights. But Jonathan, in doing research, were they as great as we think they were? How were those three fights?
Oh, they were incredible battles. And the first fight, I think, is one of the great heavyweight fights of all time. The only problem with the last two of them, and they're even fights, and there's an enormous amount of punishment being doled out, and that boxing fans love to watch guys get hit. But after the first fight, I think that they were never the same. I don't think either boxer was ever the same. That first fight took so much out of them. And by the second and third fight, it's almost painful for me to watch because they're just doing so much damage. And that third fight in particular in the Philippines, it was 100 and God knows how many degrees. And these men just look like they're near death. And Ali, in fact, said he felt like he was close to death and he felt like he never recovered. That fight did permanent damage to his brain and his body, in his own opinion.
The Ali era stretched for so long over parts of three different decades. And if he's the greatest of that era, who's the second greatest?
Oh, man, good question. You know, Joe Frazier, George Foreman, Ken Norton, they can all make a claim to it, I suppose. You know, George Foreman was absolutely dominant until the Rumble in the Jungle. And Joe Frazier was just an incredibly ferocious fighter. Ken Norton's probably, you know, I put him fourth on the list of those guys, but he gave Ali a tough time every fight. So that was a great era for heavyweight.
In talking about Frazier, and we've learned so much about the two of them, and there's another documentary just kind of on their rivalry that many of us have seen. Do you think Ali was wrong in the way that he treated Joe Frazier?
Yeah, I think it's one of the really sad points in Ali's life that he didn't see a boundary there. He called Frazier an Uncle Tom and called him, compared him to an animal, and really, really diminished, you know, a man who Ali was always talking about how important it was to lift up black people and to prove that black people were every bit as good as white people. But he treated Joe Frazier in a really brutally racist way, and he never stopped and he never knew when to quit. Maybe he was doing it to try to get under Frazier's skin and to psych him out, but maybe he was doing it to attract attention for the fight, but I still don't think it was right, and I think that somebody in Ali's camp should have told him to knock it off.
From all of your research, what do you think Ali's biggest regret was?
You know, it was funny. He was asked that question in the 70s, and his answer really shocked me. He said his biggest regret was saying those things about Vietnam and saying that that no Viet Cong ever called him the N-word because it made so many people mad. And I couldn't believe that that was his answer because that was, you know, arguably the most famous and important thing he ever said. But he explained it. He said that, you know, it upset him that he made so many people angry. And I think the really interesting revelation there is that Ali wanted to be loved even more than he wanted to be admired. And it tells you a lot about his personality.
How much
it does.
How much were women a constant weakness for him?
Oh, man, it was terrible. He slept with hundreds, maybe thousands of women. His wives knew about it all the time. His wives sometimes booking extra hotel rooms for the mistresses. They would take turns. You know, you'll be with her tonight and with her the next night. It was just an everyday part of his life. He was really bad to his wives, and was not a great husband or a father, and it was a constant problem.
What was it like talking to some of those women or the people who were affected by those flings?
It was sad, you know, to hear them describe it, especially, you know, they were young. Ali's second and third wives were very young when they got married, and they were naive, and I think that they're still struggling to deal with how it happened and why it happened. And at the same time, they still really love him. Like, their eyes just light up when they talk about him, and you can just see what an unbelievably exciting man he was to be around.
What, Jonathan Eich, author of Ali, A Life, what do you think at the end Ali's opinion was of the Nation of Islam and all the turns that took in his life?
Well, you know, when he joined the Nation of Islam, it was really mostly about race, not about religion. And later, when the Nation of Islam dissolved, when Elijah Muhammad died, the organization kind of fell apart, and the leaders took it more in the direction of Orthodox Islam. And then Ali made that transition, too, and he became a devout Orthodox Muslim. So the Nation of Islam, by the end of the 70s, really wasn't much of a factor in his life anymore. And when Louis Farrakhan decided to rebuild the Nation of Islam, he went to Ali and asked him to come back, and Ali chose not to. So I think that tells it. But it was an important part in shaping him, obviously. It, you know, he did not only change his name, but he changed his whole identity because of the Nation of Islam.
Jonathan, you said you went into this project as a fan. On the other end of the project, when you're finished, do you have more respect for him as a fighter than you did when you started?
Yeah, as a fighter, absolutely. As a person, it's much more complicated. I still really admire, and I still am really have a great deal of affection for the man. But it's also really complicated by the fact that he was very human and very flawed. So I appreciate him even more as a fighter, and I appreciate him in greater nuance as a human being.
And this is a nuanced book. You can hear all the shadings just in our conversation, and you immediately can see. We could talk about this for hours. By the way, Jonathan, do you get tired of talking about Ali at this point?
No, not yet. He's a fascinating guy, and every conversation brings up something new. So I'm having a great time.
The book is Ali, A Life. It's already being considered a classic, and it was a pleasure to talk to you about this book. And whether you love Ali or he's somebody you've never liked, I can't imagine you not enjoying this book. Congratulations on a great work, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. It's great talking to you.
Jonathan Eich, thank you. Author of Ali, A Life. AD, as you listen to that, no matter where you were on Ali to begin, you kind of want to read more about this, don't you? I mean, it's a fascinating life.
No question. And maybe even more complicated than I thought it was 15
yes.
minutes ago. And I knew his life was complicated, and there are a lot of shadings to it. But just in that 15-minute conversation, I learned a handful of things that, A, I never knew, but, B, I'd never even heard like a sniff of. The drug testing, never heard about that. I didn't know a whole lot about the womanizing. Never knew that he said his biggest regret was, you know, what he said about Vietnam. Much like Jonathan, that kind of took me aback. I was surprised by that. So that was really interesting. And yeah, like I said, more interesting of a man than I even thought he was.
Could anybody else hear the Ken Burns already going in the background? You hear the
yes.
Peter Coyote narrative?
Yes, for sure. Because
I don't know if he'll be the one that does that. He does just about all of them, but
he does a great job with those.
Great voice.
The complexity, nuance is a good word for it. I mean, most of the Ali books have been either highly critical or, you know, love fest, mm-hmm. hagiographies, and this is not either. It's just a man in full, and it hasn't been done, and this is one of the all-time most fascinating lives lived. I mean, Muhammad Ali was the most popular person in the world for a number of years.
And one of the most and as you just said, the most unpopular person in or unpopular person in America.
What
most popular, least popular,
and how do you get there? I mean, there's so many things in the book that we didn't even have time to get to, like Ali's personal trainer, Angelo Dundee, a famous name to sports fans. He served as an informant for the FBI, providing the agency with information about the Muslims surrounding Ali. He was an FBI informant.
Kind of like to hear more about his relationship with Howard Cosell. That's a really interesting. I mean,
there's so much.
That makes my day to know that Ken Burns is working on this.
There's new evidence suggesting Sonny Liston had financial incentive to throw that famous 1964 fight.
My dad is still not over that. He's still pissed off.
Ollie's grandfather
so much money on it.
Was a convicted murderer. He killed a man over a craps game, but Ali never knew it. Never knew his dad grandfather was a convicted murderer.
Told friends in the 70s he was afraid he would be murdered if he ever left the Nation of Islam.
Man, there's so much here, and Jonathan Eig is the author of Ali, A Life. We're back with Throwdowns on the Murph and Andy Show, 1460 KXNO. Don't let
me throw it down. It's time for Throwdowns. Powered by Heartland Tire and Auto Center.
Let's throw it down. Murph, 5 years ago, John Farrell led the Red Sox to a World Series championship. The last 2 years, the Sox won the AL East, but were bounced in the divisional series. Was it a good move for the Red Sox to fire John Farrell?
It's a tough call because they won the division, and he's getting fired. But if you follow the Sox at all, they had a miserable clubhouse. Chemistry was missing, as was a big masher in the middle. They didn't have a power hitter in the middle of the lineup. That probably has as much to do with the problem here as anything. But baseball is a chemistry game, and the Red Sox just don't have it. They don't have a happy, fun clubhouse. So I suppose with the money that goes into that club that they had to make this move. But John Farrell will get picked up by somebody else, and should. He did fine.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of a return on investment thing. They spend so much money on that team, and that just comes with a ton of pressure. You're expected to win. When they win the division, they're expected to win a playoff round, at least win a playoff round. And fans there have gotten a taste for world championships. So falling short of that and seeing the Yankees still alive, it's probably just too much.
Andy, personally, I'm bummed that ESPN is canceling the 24-hour college basketball marathon, something that's helped kick off the season for nearly a decade now. Andy, do you care that it's ending?
No, I mean, it's a novelty. It's something that's kind of neat to know it's out there, but it's not something I ever really partook in. So I have no problem with them canceling that. I mean, it's interesting. Maybe someday it'll be interesting to look back and think that they had it, but it's not something that I will miss because I didn't watch it anyway.
I don't care either. I mean, I file this under if you enjoyed it, I'm sorry for you. I mean, I don't take any pleasure in it coming to an end, but unless one of our teams was playing in one of the games, I didn't watch it. It's too early.
Yeah, I never sat and watched it, like the games in entirety, but it was fun to have them on. And yeah, like you and I got some national showcase opportunities every once in a while, but it is going away. Murph, U.S. soccer won't play in the World Cup next year, but apparently they're still going forward with the event, even without us, whatever. Who should we as a nation throw our support behind?
I don't think we as a nation can throw our support behind anybody these days. I think it comes down to individual groups. Most people will probably pick their country of ancestry. Some soccer fans will pick a team because they've got a great player like Messi. But I don't think there's any country that's going to pull us all together. And I know it won't be Mexico.
Yeah, I don't know that we have any real big allies anymore. I think that everybody is going to, you know, we're a melting pot. You're going to have your own, you know, your own allegiances through your family or your ancestry or something like that. I know I get a kick out of watching my Bosnian neighbors get all excited about their team. So maybe I'll root for them. Who knows? Maybe I won't watch it all.
Man, that answer was more depressing than I expected it to be. The poll is up on Twitter, at Murph_Andy, who won Throwdowns.
I mean, it's depressing to think about.
It is, but I mean, also just, you know, we can't get behind anything as a country anymore. We don't have any big allies. We don't.
Really
like, I know, I'm saying. It's all true.
Who would it
it's
be?
Just,
I mean, somebody is pissed at us for just about everything.
AD, was it the Morning Rush today, or where did the discussion start about with the bye week here, Cyclone fans turning toward Iowa City and waving to the kids at the end of the first quarter?
Yeah, I don't know where it originated. They talked about it on the Morning Rush, and we put it out on Twitter and Facebook, and it's gotten a lot of reaction today.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, nobody is anti-sick kid in the hospital. We can all agree on that. I don't think
people are even anti University of Iowa Hospital.
How could you be?
You know somebody that went there.
I do think that there are probably some people underestimating how much some of those at Iowa State University do not want their game to turn into anything that's about the University of Iowa, including the hospitals. I don't think that this will be a universal thing, but I think some people will turn and wave Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting subject. I think there is a good case against it. I do. I think there's a fair case against doing it.
Can you stop that music? Let's hear the... No, I'm kidding. We got to end hour number one here. Hour number two is coming up. We'll have some of Andy's thoughts on what we were just discussing, plus trending Iowa next on the Murph and Andy Show.